Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, and each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now here's today's podcast.
Well, hello and welcome along to the programme that aims to get you thinking. Unbelievable, it's Saturday afternoon. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half. This is the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. And we're back to our usual format this week as we have an atheist and Christian joining me on the show. And I'll be telling you who they are, what we're talking about today in a moment's time. But if you're a fan of the show, or even if you've only just discovered us, but you're interested in thinking through your faith, looking at the tough questions, why not join us for Unbelievable, the Conference 2013? It's happening here in central London on Saturday, the 25th of May. And you can see details about it at premier.org.uk/Jesus. That's because the subtitle of the conference is Jesus, Liar, Lunatic, Legend or Lord. Of course, this year is the 50th anniversary from the death of C.S. Lewis, who had a huge impact on Christian thinking, apologetics. And, well, it's kind of riffing on his so-called trilemma. Jesus is either liar, lunatic or Lord. We've added in a category of legend because that certainly has come up in the last several years. Can we trust the biblical accounts of Jesus and so forth? So all those kinds of issues are going to be addressed at the conference, including seminars on C.S. Lewis about faith being on the front line. We've got some great speakers coming along too. Alistair McGrath is renowned around the world as a Christian thinker, theologian, former scientist himself, former atheist at one time. He's going to be speaking to us. Amy Orr Ewing of the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics is going to be presenting on evidence for Jesus in the Bible. We've got Peter S. Williams, Christian philosopher. We've got Fuzz Rana from Reasons to Believe. We've got Trevor Stammers of the Christian Medical Fellowship and other special guests joining us who I'll be revealing in a week or two as well as we get the final ends, odds and ends tied down. But do check it out and see if you're available. Ring fence it in your diary. Saturday the 25th of May, Unbelievable, the Conference 2013. Details at premier.org.uk/Jesus. Well, don't forget you can get in touch with today's programme. I'm going to be giving you the ways to do that a little later on in the show. And we've got a lot of feedback to last week's programme with Tom Wright and James White. It was Wright versus White last week. So stay tuned towards the end of today's show for more on what happened in the aftermath of that. For the moment, let's get into the topic of today's show.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today we're asking the question, I just believe in one less God than you. What do we make of that claim by some atheists? And to help us think through that and to see where that rabbit trail goes, Randall Rouser is a Christian theologian and apologist in Edmonton, Canada. I may be mispronouncing his name and he'll be able to set me right if I am. But he's the author of The Swedish Atheist, The Scuba Diver and Other Apologetic Rabbit Trails. Randall, I know, is a listener of the show, and so it's great to have him on the programme in person. Ralph Jones is my atheist guest today, and Ralph performs with a comedy group called The Awkward Silence. He's also a writer for numerous publications. Recently appeared in Christianity magazine in their Why I'm Not a Christian column, so we'll find out a bit about that as well as we go on in the show today. For the moment, let me first of all say a hello to Randall, who joins us from across the pond. Randall, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me, Justin. Good to finally get on the show and great to be with you.
Yeah, because you've been listening to the show for a while now. How did you kind of come across it, if you can remember back that far?
I can't remember back that far, but I've been listening for several years now and have always enjoyed it. So
great.
Great to be with you.
Because I guess it ties in a lot with what you do, Randall. You've obviously got an interest in apologetics, in theology, in thinking through your faith. That's what you help students to do in the seminary where you work?
Yes, and one thing I remember is I blogged a couple years ago about Unbelievable, and what I appreciated about the show is there are a lot of open conversations that you sponsor and you host, which you're just not finding as often in North America. So you know, this kind of open dialogue is something we really need, something I try to promote among students and in the churches. And so I appreciate that you're doing it over there.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, Randall. Tell us a little of your background and how you got into doing what you're currently doing.
Well, I was raised in the church in a Pentecostal tradition. I went to a Christian university back in the early 90s, and I was kind of an apologetics nerd at the time. So on Friday nights, I'd get together with friends, and we'd get a William Lane Craig debate video and eat pizza and watch debates. And I just never got that out of my system, this idea of thinking hard about important issues and dialoguing with other people on it. So I was in London. I did my PhD at King's College, University of London, about 12 years ago, and came back to Canada, and I've been doing the same things that I love and been very blessed to be able to do that ever since.
So your latest book, The Swedish Atheist, The Scuba Diver and Other Apologetic Rabbit Trails, it imagines really what we do here on the show kind of happening over the course of a day in a coffee shop. Just tell us a little bit about what the aim of that book is.
Yeah, so I've read many apologetics books over the years, and what I've noticed often is that they will present arguments well, but they don't always present arguments, or rarely do they present arguments in the way that they often arise in real-life conversation. And so what I did basically was go back to the venerable old Platonic dialogue kind of framework, but with a little bit of a narratival structure to it. And I set up a conversation between me and a fictional atheist named Sheridan, where we go through conversations on the existence of God as they might arise in a conversation over several hours in a coffee shop. And it was just a great platform to be able to bring together all these different arguments that you might hear and that have interested me over the years and have a really honest dialogue and hopefully a disarming one as well, because I didn't come into it with a sort of triumphalist sense where, you know, I'm going to convert the atheist at the end. Rather, one where he lands some blows and I land some blows, so to speak, and we mutually push each other along in understanding. So it was a lot of fun to put that book together.
Yeah, and I've enjoyed reading it, and I do think it is. It's not just your pat answers, and as you say, the real world of actually dialoguing, discussing these things. It's not a kind of one side has all the winning arguments and the other shrivels up. It is there's arguments for and against, blows are landed on either side, as you say. I wish I just had some kind of coffee shop atmosphere now that I'm thinking about it in the background, so we could pretend we're having that conversation here in the studio. But
I do have a coffee, and I could make slurping noises.
Could you just clink
helps.
It occasionally, and that'll help to increase that sort of feel, if you would. Yes, no budget, I'm afraid, for fancy sound effects on this program. But my other guest is Ralph Jones. As I mentioned, he's an atheist and performs with a comedy group called The Awkward Silence. Also, increasingly doing a lot of writing for various publications. Ralph, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
It's great to have you on. I kind of came across you because of the Christianity magazine article, and I saw some of your other stuff online. The article is quite interesting. You know, it comes across as quite strident, almost your atheism. Though I don't, as far as I'm aware, see any sort of that you're reacting negatively to religious experiences in the past. I don't know if you had any kind of religious experience growing up.
In fact, not at all. I mean, I was raised in and I'm still being raised in a non-religious house. I'm not reacting against any kind of fundamentalist Christianity, and in that sense it's a little bit of a mystery. It's not a reaction against anything. It's just through reading various books, like obviously things like The God Delusion and God Is Not Great by Chris Hitchens, as well as coming up against Christians in real life, coming up against Christian reactions to various political events, political developments, issues like same-sex marriage, things like that. So I have found it very difficult not to be involved, become involved, and in a way kind of, take up a position against it in my eyes. And I think that can often be misinterpreted, and it can often be construed as being offensive or construed as being very aggressive, when in fact what I like to point out is the amount of damage that is done, both literal, both in the real world and, in my opinion, intellectually, as the result of an ongoing respect, you know, too much of a respect for religious faith, I think.
Well, you obviously have been an atheist a long time.
Yeah, but not deliberately. I mean, I would say no. I just didn't have any opinion on religion until I was about, you know, in my teens or whatever. I mean, as I say in the article, for those who haven't read it, I did originally when I was a small boy. I must have had some kind of remnant of a faith, although not a kind of theistic faith, but a general kind of
yes.
God must be up there kind of faith. And therefore, I kind of kneeled down and would occasionally pray to God, thinking, like I say in the article, that he would make me taller.
Oh, he did.
And I'm taller than I was as a child, so now I believe in God. No, it's not been a feature of my personality. I don't think all my life I just lacked faith, and now I would say have read.
And you've read around the subject now. Obviously, you haven't been convinced by anything you've read from the apologetic side, and so from that perspective, for you, it's as clear as ever.
Yeah, quite. It's now informed by. I mean, everyone has their own interpretation, so I can't say I am right and someone else is wrong, as black and white as that. But I have come to the decision that obviously I believe my opinion to be the correct one, but it's now based on a considerable...
Well, we might come back to some of the things you say in the article and that kind of thing. But we're talking primarily on the show today. This is where our discussion will start out, at any rate, with that kind of atheist aphorism. I just believe in one less God than you. I think sometimes to give it its fuller... if you like, context, I've heard Richard Dawkins say, well, with respect to all the gods that are out there, we're both atheists, as far as all that's concerned. I just happen to believe in one less God than you. It's quite a good one-liner. And we'll talk about what, you know, whether there's anything in that, what you think of that, what Randall thinks of that as we go on in the programme today. I did mention if you want to get in touch, I would give out the details. And if you want to email, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also get in touch via our Twitter and Facebook pages, twitter.com/unbelievablejb. That's the handle, unbelievablejb, or facebook.com/unbelievablejb, or just search for Unbelievable on Facebook. You should be able to find the page fairly easily. Don't forget all the links to my guest today and indeed past programmes, information about the conference and so forth, all available from the Unbelievable webpage. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, let's crack on with the subject of today's show. Let's give you the chance to start out on this, Ralph. That statement, I just believe in one less God than you, is that one you've used? Is that one you think is valid in some way? Is it a useful way of expressing something?
I don't use it myself. I mean, I think it's misleading in the sense that we've got to differentiate between someone that believes that God created the world and is in that sense a deist, in other words, doesn't subscribe to any particular faith, particular organized religion, and someone that says, you know, I am a member of an organized religion. I think that my one God, in this sense, a Christian God, is the answer, is the solution to all of life's problems. I mean, there's a very big distinction there, and I don't think that therefore the statement is particularly useful, because to be an atheist is also, I think, to be an adeist, in other words, to say that not only are all of these religions false, but, you know, God didn't create the universe and we have better ways of explaining it. So in that sense, I think to be someone that isn't a theist is to say, I believe in one less God than you. But to be a deist, you know, is an entirely different thing. And I think it's theism which atheists are much more concerned about. So in other words, deism isn't doing any particular damage, and deism
just having a vague belief in a force
and
behind the universe.
That's right, and isn't inherently damaging. Whereas I think that people that believe they have identified one man or you know, a group of people who are in some sense divine means that they can justify a lot more than a deist would, for example. I think it's a lot more inherently dangerous, and also much easier to kind of mount arguments against. The
right.
The argument against the existence of any god in terms of first cause, in terms of someone, I say someone, something who created the universe, is unlikely to ever be resolved. I mean, that's something that you can only have a kind of an informed opinion on. You can't really say we have disproved or we have proved the existence of God, in my opinion. Whereas theism, I find, is a lot more obviously man-made.
So you're speaking of theism in the context of having a very particular view of what that God is, whereas deism, if it has a God at all, it's unspecified,
But also, deists don't contend that that God intervenes. Deists don't contend that he cares about us, that he does any of these things. And I'm in danger of repeating Chris Fitchin's speech, but deists don't contend that God cares about all of the trivial things that go on in our lives, whereas theists very much do, and therefore have to come up with an answer.
So if you're responding to theism,
yep,
particularly, you might be willing to say there's something in this phrase,
I believe in one
less God than you.
Yeah.
Deism, you're dealing with something a bit different.
Because Christianity, for example, and any monotheism, isn't content with saying we believe that the laws of the universe don't make sense without a creator. They have to go one further and say he has revealed himself in this world. So in other words, yes, that's very distinct from deism.
Let's talk to Randall. Randall, already Ralph has been sort of explaining where he sees the land lying on this. Perhaps you want to comment on his categories of deism and theism and so forth. Perhaps, though, just to kick us off, what do you make of that phrase, I just believe in one less God than you?
Yeah, so let's begin with that phrase itself. I think rhetorically the phrase does have value in the sense that, or it has a function, that it's trying to address certain stereotypes about atheists. You know, the idea that atheists have horns hidden under their their hat or something like that. Mm. And statistics do show in surveys that atheists are among the most distrusted people in society. And I think one of the points of that kind of statement is to say, hey, we're not that much different than you. We can have all sorts of agreement about all kinds of issues. And, you know, in that much I certainly agree with. In fact, there are many atheists that I would share much more with in terms of culture or in terms of some political views than many Christians. So I think, you know, those are good things to remember. Mm. In terms of the definitions that we're working with, the word theism, in its most basic sense, does simply mean belief that there is a God. So in that sense, deism is a token example of theism. It's a type of theism. Christian theism would be a type of theism that says the God that exists has revealed himself in different ways. So, you know, it's depending on how we're using terms. But I don't see any essential disjunction between theism and deism. I think the way that theism is minimally defined is consistent with being a deist. I think Ralph's right that many atheists are much more sanguine or comfortable with deism rather than theism. E.O. Wilson is an example of a naturalist who's expressed affinity with deism. At different points in his life, Carl Sagan did as well. And I think that there's a certain connection there between finding a rational structure in the universe. You know, what Einstein famously talked about, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. And moving from there to this understanding of there being some kind of mind behind the universe, and then to the fact that maybe there is a God behind the universe. And I agree that often the concern arises when we begin to talk about God revealing himself in special ways in history. And so that's often where the disputes start.
Indeed. When it comes to the many gods that have been posited in history, I think that's where this phrase is often launching from. And so the atheist using it might say, you know, I don't believe in Thor, Odin, Zeus, nor do you. So we're all atheists with respect to those particular gods. I just happen to disbelieve in one less god than you, and that would be the Christian God, Yahweh. And so just sticking with you for a moment, Randall, then coming to Ralph, what's your response to that specifically, that somehow we're atheists with regard to all kinds of supernatural entities and gods, and being an atheist is just actually ticking one more off the list?
Well, it's a little bit confused as a use of a term, because I'm not an atheist with respect to Zeus. Rather, I don't believe Zeus exists, but I'm a theist the whole time, because I do believe a god exists. So I find that there's a certain rhetorical use of terms here, which is confusing issues. I'm a Christian theist, but yes, I believe Zeus doesn't exist. So then we could move into the question, well, what grounds could a person have to believe one set of descriptions about God is correct rather than another set of descriptions? And that would be another conversation to have as to why I don't believe Zeus is a live option for being a correct description of who God is. But to say I'm an atheist with respect to Zeus, I think it's just a confusion of terms, because I'm a theist.
What do you make of it all then,
Ralph? I think we're in danger of splitting hairs, really. I mean, the point is, as from an atheistic perspective, is that the evidence on in support of all these gods is almost always exactly the same. So in other words, we have no more reason for believing Islam to be true than we have for believing Christianity to be true. I mean, that's just very demonstrably true, given how often people inherit the beliefs of their parents and of their community. People can convert to other faiths, but it's statistically very unlikely. So in other words, it's the contention on the atheistic front that you don't reach an understanding or an evidentially based belief in the particular theism you subscribe to. You're just told, well, I'm a Christian, I've been brought up in a Christian faith, I'm a Muslim, I've been brought up in the Muslim faith. I'm therefore going to retrospectively examine the evidence for my faith and justify it, often to a remarkable extent. In the case of some apologists like William Craig, for example, I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, it's in my opinion so obviously retrospectively justifying passages of scripture, for example, when it's much more palpably the case that people are just believing in the same God that their
parents believe. So you're making the case then that when it comes to the gods that exist out there and the evidence for them and whether we believe in them or not, by and large, for the vast majority of people, they believe in what their parents told them, what their culture they grew up in, and then if they want to retrospectively find reasons, they'll find reasons for that god.
Well,
be
I mean,
it the god of Islam,
there's, yeah,
Christianity.
There's no point saying that's even, you know, that's not even 99% of people. That is admittedly the majority of cases, but there's no point ignoring the fact that people convert all the time, or that people are apparently atheists before studying the Bible and then say it was through studying the Bible that I became a Christian. I think it's much more common to be a believer, study the holy texts of your faith, and then lose faith. That's much more. That's much more common.
Okay, Randall, does he have a point here, Ralph?
Well, I think it is common for any person to begin by adopting the beliefs of their parents and the dispositions of their parents. I think I'm evidence of that. I think Ralph is evidence of that as well. So we begin by adopting a certain view of the world, and then it behooves each one of us to defend that view of the world against rational objections. So if Ralph is going to take a non-theistic view of the world, I think the challenge for him is to defend that. Likewise for me as a Christian. I think we need to keep in mind one basic distinction here. Going back to the original statement that an atheist believes just in one less God, and that's this, that when we try to understand things about the world, we have two basic kinds of explanation we can appeal to. The one kind of explanation is an agent-causal explanation. In other words, it attributes an event or a circumstance to an agent. The other kind of explanation is one that attributes an event or circumstance to a non-agent. So let's say that you have Mrs. Jones is staying at home alone on a Friday night, and she hears a thump in the basement, and it sounds like one of her jam jars fell off the shelf. She could attribute that event to a non-agent. Perhaps the jam jar was simply at the edge of the shelf and it fell off. Or she could attribute it to an agent, let's say a burglar in the basement. And there's a big difference between those two views of what happened. Likewise, when you go to explain the nature of the universe or of existence, you have those two basic options. You can appeal to an agent or a non-agent. A Christian, as a theist, is appealing to an agent to explain the nature of the universe. Ralph, as an atheist, is appealing to a non-agent. And the challenge is for both of us to develop reasons, grounds, to defend our interpretation of reality.
I agree. I just think you're still a deist, in other words. You're still saying, I'm giving the world... I detect in the world the properties of an agent. You know, I detect an agent here somehow. I think that's a very bold statement to make, and I think all atheists do, to try and determine that some mind must have been at the cause of it, because obviously then you have to justify, well, how did that entity get there? But I think the point is to jump from saying I subscribe to this belief in an agency to saying, right, well, on top of that, he was revealed to us through contradictory texts and through bizarre miracles and through, obviously, man-made myths. That's an enormous jump to make. And, you know, is based on the same evidence that a Mormon would have for believing in Mormonism. There's a consistency through atheism which just says that we don't manipulate, we can't manipulate the laws of nature. And in terms of Einstein's quote in your opening statement, you said, you know, the most incomprehensible thing about the world is that it is comprehensible. He also said, you know, it's amazing. The miracle is that there are no miracles. So in other words, he would contend that it's impossible to perform miracles. That's the jump that the theist has to make. That
we'll allow Randall to come straight back onto that. We're going to go to our first break just now. Time running away as ever on this show, but we'll hear what Randall has to say in response to Ralph there, who is our atheist guest today. We started out at least from the question, does it make sense, this claim of some atheists, I just believe in one less God than you? We're getting into now whether there is evidence for the claims of theism, claims of atheism. Randall says we both need to defend our worldview. We both need to, you know, look at the objections and the evidence for or against. Randall Rouser, Christian theologian and apologist from Canada with me today, author of The Swedish Atheist, The Scuba Diver and Other Apologetic Rabbit Trails. We're having a conversation here on God, theism, atheism and much more besides. Come back for part two in a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio this Saturday afternoon. You can find us online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Many past programmes available there, iTunes link, the podcast features, and of course links to the conference, which you can now go and check out the details for. Are you available Saturday the 25th of May? We're going to be joined by some fabulous speakers, including Alistair McGrath, our keynote speaker for Unbelievable, the conference 2013. Check it out at premier.org.uk/Jesus. Just a reminder, you can get in touch with this program as well. Why not send me an email? That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. On the show today, Randall Rouser, Christian theologian and apologist, joins me. He's the author of The Swedish Atheist, The Scuba Diver and Other Apologetic Rabbit Trails. It's an imagined conversation between himself and an atheist. Well, he's got a real atheist today in front of him. Well, at least in the studio across the other side of the world. But hey, we live in a modern age. All things are possible. Ralph Jones is my atheist guest. Performs with a comedy group called The Awkward Silence. He's doing a lot of writing recently as well for various publications. Recently interviewed by Christianity magazine for their Why I'm Not a Christian, which was what sparked me to get hold of Ralph for the programme today. And we're going to be talking about why Ralph is an atheist rather than a Christian, whether there are good claims for the truth of Christianity, and Randall is going to be speaking to that as well as we go. But Coming back to you, Randall, in that last section we had Ralph suggesting that essentially what you've described in terms of the intelligibility of the universe and so on is really deism, and that if you're going to add in a lot of extra stuff about Jesus and the Bible and so forth, that's when you start building your version of theism. So do you want to talk about that and whether it is then getting very implausible, as Ralph obviously feels it does at that point become?
Yeah, so we're back again to the definitional issue. What I described is not deism. What I described is a theism, a minimal theism, which underdetermines any further claims. So I described a type of theism. The next question is, well, how do you get to deism or to Christian theism or to anything else? And I mean, here, one thing we have to say is we are in the age of the flying spaghetti monster, and it's sort of an age where isolating theological claims to try to make them look absurd as akin to a flying spaghetti monster or an invisible pink unicorn or fairyology, as Richard Dawkins likes to say, that's sort of become this cottage industry. So one thing I would like to begin by saying is if you take any specialized knowledge discourse and isolate certain claims, theoretical claims made in that discourse, apart from any context as to how the practitioners of the discourse arrived at the claims, then you can make the claims look absurd. If you want, for instance, to describe the pizza you had for lunch yesterday by saying, you know, a physicist says this is comprised of vibrating packets of energy in empty space, you can mock it. You can make it look absurd, because why would anybody think the pizza is made of that? The only way you're going to come to appreciate that description of the pizza is by appreciating the way, the reasons, the grounds that physicists have for adopting that description. Same thing in philosophy. Philosophy is full of claims which on the face of it seem extraordinary. The only way you come to appreciate those claims is by understanding how a philosopher arrives at those claims. It's the same thing with robust theological claims about who this God is that's behind the universe and how we relate to him. You can't just isolate the claim and say, well, that's clearly absurd. And I hear a little bit of that coming through in Ralph's description, saying, obviously, these are myths and so on, and wanting to be as quick as he can to dismiss and marginalize a Christian description of who God is. Rather, we need to take the time to understand why Christians adopt the kinds of views and descriptions of God that they do.
I mean, I agree with you, and think that it shouldn't necessarily just be dismissed, although I would contend that everyone does exactly the same thing for any religion they don't subscribe to. You don't need to invest a huge amount of time in dismissing the claims of Scientology. We all know Scientology is very probably false. Now, how have we reached that conclusion? Well, I mean, on the atheist front, we contend that religions are going to multiply and are going to be manufactured by human creatures, and that therefore they will have all of the same flaws and all of the same inconsistencies. But on what basis can you say as a Christian that the claims of Scientology aren't valid, for example? You presume that they're not, but I mean, you have to devote the same amount of careful study and time as you have done, you know, admirably for your own faith. But I just mean there's a consistency with atheism, which is just that if these faiths look man-made and smell man-made, then they very probably are.
Let's allow Randall to come back on that then. Mm. Go ahead, Randall.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that is kind of a pebble in my shoe for the way Ralph is describing the issue is he keeps talking about quote-unquote religion. Now, there's no clear definition he's provided as to what this thing we're calling religion is, but he's describing all these people who have religions and then himself as an atheist. I think what is more helpful and less prejudicial in this kind of conversation is to talk about everyone who's at the table of conversation right now having a worldview, everybody having a set of commitments or a life philosophy which they're committed to defending, and something I tried to describe earlier on in this conversation. Each one of us has to defend something, and there are certain claims Ralph makes about the nature of reality which strike me as initially very implausible, if not ridiculous, just as there are claims I make that strike Ralph as implausible, if not ridiculous.
Well, should we try doing maybe 10 minutes where you ask some questions about Ralph's worldview, okay, Randall, and then maybe Ralph asked for 10 minutes, asked some questions about your worldview and some of the objections he has. And we'll try and make this fairly snappy.
Sure.
Okay, so that we get a bit of to and fro going here. All right, so you've just said there are things about Ralph's worldview that you find implausible. Do you want to just spell one or two of them out and see what Ralph says in response?
Well, yeah, let me say some things I find difficult about atheism and then get Ralph's response to it. I'll give a couple quick ones. So first of all, one that's come up a lot in recent years, the origin of biological information in DNA. I mean, in DNA, you have the equivalent of 28 encyclopedias worth of information in every cell. I'd be interested to hear, in Ralph's view, what kind of natural known processes there are that can generate that kind of specified biological information. The other thing I would say ask in a short time is how Ralph distinguishes between a life objectively well-lived versus a life not objectively well-lived. As a Christian theist, I have a ground to say, well, the life Mother Teresa lived is objectively a better life lived than, say, the life of a pornographer. And I would be interested to hear what Ralph's grounds are for adjudicating what is a life well-lived and what isn't.
Okay, well, in 10 minutes, Ralph, two subjects. I mean, we're starting with... Yes,
well, start with Mother Teresa, if you don't mind. I don't think, you know, I don't think that the life of Mother Teresa would have been a more moral life than that of a pornographer at all. I don't think that in any sense. I think that leading people to believe in something... and saying, you know, leading people to believe in something that is very unlikely to be true, in my opinion, but holding that as the requisite belief for salvation, and saying that things like abortion are equivalent to murder is not objectively good, let alone subjectively.
Okay, how about Richard Dawkins versus a Nazi?
I don't know what that's supposed to prove, but Richard Dawkins is leading, in my opinion, a more objectively good life than a Nazi. But how does Christianity help you with determining that? I mean,
let's just see. I think we need what Ralph wants to hear from you, Randall. Is what's your point? Okay, yeah, he believes Richard Dawkins is leading an objectively better life,
but not a perfect life,
what's the point then, Randall? Are you saying that on an atheistic worldview, Ralph can't make that judgment?
Well, I'd just like to hear on what basis he does make it. I mean, as a Christian, I believe that objective meaning and value are rooted in the nature of the necessary agent that created the universe, and that by living in accord with the inherent goodness of who God is, we conform ourselves to that good, then we are more or less objectively living a good and meaningful life. So I would like to hear from Ralph's perspective as an atheist, assuming, you know, that we just evolved randomly with no purpose, then where did his basis for making the judgment as to Richard Dawkins' life being better than a Nazi come from?
I hear this argument a lot, and it's one I still don't really understand in terms of it lending weight to a Christian worldview. I mean, if morality is to be found objectively in the Christian God, then why is slavery permitted for so long? I mean, it's a classic question, but one that the Christian can't possibly escape.
I think, though, in this case, obviously, you can certainly ask that question when we come to questioning the Christian worldview. But in this case, Randall's just asking, as an atheist, how do you determine? Not kind of judging whether Christians do it correctly or not, or have any
appeal
to anything. But do you yourself, as an atheist, have any... scale by which you are judging Dawkins' against a Nazi?
We don't have a scale. We don't have a book we need to look to. We don't have to rely on the words of scriptures. We don't have to infer the existence of a deity. It's just
how do you tell then?
Well, is he doing harm to people? Is he literally killing people? We've evolved to hold the view that killing people is bad because it wipes out communities, it wipes out individual members of tribes. We wouldn't have got as far as we have without the belief that killing people is bad. I mean, it's an evolutionary...
So it's kind of a natural outworking of evolution. You fare better if you've...
And it's one that's being improved upon all the time. I mean, in my submission, we are growing to be more and more moral, more and more ethical, as we become less and less religious. I mean...
Let's allow Randall, then. We'll try and keep this... quick fire. What's your response there, Randall?
So Ralph talks as if morality and meaning are objective measures. He just talked about humans evolving and becoming more moral with respect to some objective standard, and I'm just wondering where he believes that standard comes from. What's its ontological status?
I don't have an objective framework for it. I don't think anyone does. I think we just look after ourselves. We look after our fellow human beings.
So it's subjectively derived then. It's individuals or the species decides what's valuable or meaningful?
Exactly. Yeah. The species does decide. I mean, otherwise, why all the discrepant opinions on morality invoked in various holy books? It's not a solution to the problem. People are always going to have the problem of how to behave well. That is always going to be an inherent problem in human life.
Is it not that behaving well, that's the question. How do we judge what is well? Because if the Nazis had one, and we were all sat here believing because of their brainwashing that the Jews should have been gassed and so on, would we then be wrong about that, or would that just be the way things are because that's the way things have evolved? Good point.
I mean, obviously, I contend that we would be less moral, and I think the majority of
people... So there is a definite moral issue at stake then on that front.
Well, yes, but I mean, it's subjective, really.
In as much as if the Nazis had won, then it would just be a subjective opinion, and then us thinking.
Had the Nazis won, we would all have been converted to belief that massacring Jews was a good idea. I really don't think that could magically have happened.
That was the way a lot of people in Germany thought at the time. So it does happen, even if it doesn't happen universally.
No, of course, people
happens.
People can be corrupted.
But those people are wrong. They're corrupted. So the question is, how do you judge who's right? Was it the Nazis then or us now? And by what standard are you making the judgment?
I would make the judgment on my own admittedly subjective perspective on life. I mean, that's not inherently problematic, I don't think, to say killing people is evil, is something that we have grown up to adopt as a worldview. And it's also something that we have constantly to fight against religious fanaticism on.
Randall, we're nearly approaching the end of your 10 minutes, and I've already been bringing in my own questions as well. So go for it. What do you want to say in response?
Well, it just seems to me from what I've been hearing from Ralph that what I appreciate is a deep sense of moral indignation at certain injustices in the world. What I haven't been hearing is a clearly thought out ethical basis to ground in a meta ethic those various intuitions and moral indignations. And what I think it would be great for Ralph to appreciate is one of the reasons people adopt an agent causal theistic view of the universe is because they find it to be a more adequate and satisfactory way to ground the very moral intuitions that drive Ralph.
In that case, can I ask a question? Why do we need the scriptures? Why do we need the holy books? If they get so many things wrong, if they get homosexuality wrong, if they get slavery wrong, in what sense is morality improved by invoking these obviously man-made text? The problem may be in assessing how we determine what is objectively moral, but it's not adequate to say therefore theism provides one with an adequate moral framework. I mean, if that were the case, all of the holy books that are have been invented in God's name would be perfectly fitting with all of the views we hold now. They're obviously products of their time.
Well, I'm not really interested in defending holy books per se. I can certainly talk about the Bible. And from a Christian perspective, every Christian has, when they read the Bible, there are many different views on different issues reflected in the Bible through 66 books and over a millennium in which it was written. So what a person does is they adopt certain interpretive controls. Well, and for me as a Christian, my focus, the beginning of my interpretation and reading of Scripture, is rooted in Jesus. It's what we call a Christocentric hermeneutic, or it's centered in Jesus. And the belief that in Jesus, God is revealed to us, John 14:8-9. So if you want to know who God is and how to relate to other people, you follow Jesus. And that becomes the interpretive grid through which I engage with the rest of Scripture. So, for instance, when I go to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5-7, I find an extraordinary challenge, which says morality and following God and being a good person is not simply about your external actions, it's about the character within. And that's an enormously challenging ethical framework. When you find in Matthew 25, Jesus distinguishes the sheep from the goats and talks about the sheep, his true followers, being the ones who have taken care of the weak and the indigent and the marginalized, I find there an extraordinary challenging ethical framework in which to live my life.
I mean, that's fine. I don't agree with you. Obviously, we have a fundamental difference. I don't agree with you that it's necessary to believe that in not subscribing to these beliefs, to these preachments, that one is damned forever in eternity. I don't think that's moral. I don't think that it's necessary to do that to people.
We're moving on now, obviously, into your 10 minutes, as it were, started with that question to Ralph. But this is another question then. Is there a kind of, you've got a moral problem with the Christian worldview, which is that you believe it condemns people to hell.
Definitely, yeah.
And,
well,
that for you is a definite moral problem with believing.
It's the biggest of all problems. It's in my eyes the biggest of Christianity's problems, the biggest of any religion's problems. It's the promise of something that can't possibly be known in advance. And more importantly, the threat of excruciating torture for those that disagree with you. I mean, it's, in my eyes, completely obvious that if you want people to believe something, the best thing to do is to say that if you don't believe it, you'll be damned for eternity. That's not a good basis for believing in something, and it doesn't make it any more true. And it's also, I really wish people would stop invoking Jesus as a great moral teacher. If someone says something like that, it's my contention that that's not moral teaching. That is actually wicked. That's actively terrifying people.
Kind of, oddly enough, coming back to our whole thing about how we decide what is moral or not. But yeah, just going with this issue, Randall, how do you respond? This is a big problem for Ralph with Christian belief. It's one reason why he rejects the Christian thesis, because he says it's immoral to claim that people who don't believe it are going to spend eternity in hell.
So, well, I appreciate it, Justin, that you're noting there that Ralph's objection is a moral objection, and I still haven't heard an adequate explanation for his own background meta-ethical framework which justifies his indignation. But separating that issue, I will address this question. And first thing I'll say is this is a matter of dispute among Christians as to understanding the nature of hell in the afterlife. So this is not an issue on which Christianity is to be judged true or false. There are some Christians which certainly are defenders of eternal conscious torment, the view that Ralph is describing and which he's objecting to. And I would suspect that there's certainly still the majority position today. But there are other Christians, such as myself, who are annihilationists, who believe there will be a general resurrection to judgment, but not an eternal suffering, eternal torture. And that there are other Christians who are universalists. I believe you've had Robin Perry on your program.
I have, yes.
So he's an evangelical. He's a friend of mine, and he's a universalist. And so, I mean, what he's showing is you can be a universalist. You can believe that posthumously in the afterlife, ultimately everybody will be reconciled to God. Kevin Miller, another friend of mine, he directed a documentary last year called Hellbound, where he explores universalism and provides a case for it. So, I mean, there's a diversity of views on the afterlife. A Christian or a person who has a moral objection to eternal conscious torment, that is not in and of itself a moral objection to Christianity per se.
In what sense does Christianity provide any sort of salvation then? If we're all going to be annihilated, I'm going to press you on what your definition of an afterlife is and what your view on people's fates after death are. But I mean, in what sense does it matter then? I mean, if I die and you subscribe to a worldview in which you know, I wasn't quite clear on which you subscribe to. But
annihilationism. So essentially, you will cease to exist if you don't embrace
then
God.
Then that's absolutely fine with me. I would rather have that than an eternal afterlife with God. In what sense is it trying to dissuade people against believing in Christianity? In other words, if it's not even going to save you in the afterlife, really, if it's not, if the two options are eternal life with God or nothing at all, if you're a member of the wrong religion or an atheist, then what's the salvation? What's the what are you getting as a reward? Because it seems to me the offer of the reward and the punishment of torment if you don't believe, that's what Christianity is based on. I mean, from what are you saving yourself otherwise?
Well, I mean, I would think capital punishment is a pretty serious punishment, something to be avoided. So the fact that a person would be resurrected to destruction, after which they would cease to exist, is still an extraordinarily serious thing, especially if what you're giving up is an eternal life of maximal fulfillment with God and a restored creation. I think one of the things that maybe is helpful here is there's a sense that, well, this is just arbitrary. It's just God says, follow me, or, you know, I will punish you. I think a better way maybe to think about it is analogous to breathing. I mean, as Paul says in Acts 17, in him we live and move and have our being, the Christian understanding of God is that he's the ultimate source of all being, meaning, and goodness. If a person says, you know what, I'm not going to breathe anymore, I'm just going to cut off oxygen because I don't want oxygen anymore, and that's going to have a critical impact on the organism's flourishing. And from a Christian perspective, that is analogous to what a person is doing when they say, I want to have nothing to do with the ultimate source of all meaning and goodness in the universe.
The comparison of not breathing with not believing in God is extraordinary. It's equating not living with not subscribing to a certain theistic worldview. I think it's absolutely extraordinary. And I think moreover, it's very insulting to people that don't believe in God. It's essentially saying you have rejected the offer of life. You have refused to breathe, in other words. And I think it's an extraordinary claim made on...
I mean, one way I've heard it put, if you don't mind me weighing in, is that I've heard, for instance, Christopher Hitchens, we already mentioned him, saying, well, you know, if I came face to face with my maker, I would sort of spit in his face and say, I want nothing to do with you, you know, because he doesn't like the idea of a sort of celestial dictator or whatever, the way he puts it. Mm-hmm. And I think to some extent that may be where Randall's coming from, is if you don't want that God in the first place, why would you say yes to eternal life with him? Because that would be the worst place to be if you hate the idea of God in the first place. You don't want God. So I suppose that there's that question of, say, you know, you did die and you discovered God is there after all, but you still have the option either accept him or reject him. Would you still reject him and you'd rather have the nothingness than the eternal life with God?
Of course, yeah, of course. I mean, I think...
So then in that case...
I think it's insane to wish otherwise. I think eternal life in any sense...
I think that's what then Randall's saying, is that you're then cutting yourself off from the oxygen stream, if you like. That's your choice to say, I'm going to stop breathing now because I don't want anything to do with God.
Yeah, I just think it's an extraordinary equation to make. I think it's extraordinary to say that not basing one's life around scripture or a belief in God, you know, on which we believe that there's very little evidence. Saying that that's the same thing as refusing a kind of
let's
reward.
Just we've got a minute before we have to come to the end of this section. So just quickly, have you overstated that? That's what Ralph seems to be saying, Randall. It's not equivalent.
Well, first, Ralph reiterated there's no evidence. He didn't even try to respond to the DNA information point I made, and I didn't find him at all providing an adequate response to the morality issue. And his ground of morality. So I think I provided two good grounds of evidence for Christian theism, or theism generally, and I didn't find that his objection to hell was sustainable, because I pointed out, well, there are different views of the afterlife that Christians hold. in terms of our understanding of God, a Christian understands God to be the maximally perfect being there could be and the source of all meaning and good. So simply from a definitional issue, if a human wants to flourish, if they want to achieve shalom or live well, then to live well will be to live in accord with the ultimate meaning, a source of meaning and goodness in the universe. I don't find anything particularly offensive or extraordinary about that. And repeating multiple times that a person finds it extraordinary is just an example of personal incredulity, but it doesn't necessarily mean the claim is extraordinary.
We'll let you respond in a moment's time. We must hit a break now. You're listening to Unbelievable. Atheist and Christian join me today. Randall Rouser is our Christian. Ralph Jones, our atheist. We'll be back in a short moment's time as we continue this conversation. Welcome back to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. The final part of today's show as we conclude our discussion, a very interesting discussion today, between atheist Ralph Jones and Christian theologian and apologist Randall Rouser. Again, we're going to give you the links for those guys before they leave us today so that you can find out more about them. We started off with a question about, I just believe in one less God than you. We've gone in all kinds of directions since then. If you come back next week, by the way, we've already been hearing a little bit about hell and Ralph's objections to it and Randall explaining that, well, there's more than one way of looking at it anyway. We're actually going to be exploring those very three options that Randall laid on the table there next week. Annihilationism, universalism, and what's sometimes called eternal conscious torment. It's in response as well to the chap that Randall mentioned there, Kevin Miller, who has produced a documentary film called Hellbound, in which he questions the traditional views of hell and investigates the idea of universalism, something that certainly came onto the scene in a big way 2 years ago in the Christian world when Rob Bell published his book Love Wins. Well, we're going back to that subject next week as we hear from Kevin Miller, and we'll be hearing from an annihilationist in the form of Glenn Peoples, who is a Christian theologian and philosopher in New Zealand, and someone defending the traditional doctrine of eternal conscious torment, Peter Sanlon, will be joining me. So that's what's on the bill next week, an in-depth look at different Christian views on hell. Come back for that same time next week. Don't forget, you can find details about today's program and information on Unbelievable, the Conference 2013, Jesus, Liar, Lunatic, Legend or Lord, at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Some of your feedback to come following the conclusion of today's discussion between Randall and Ralph. So if you want to get in touch, once again, the email address is unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget, you can find us on Twitter at UnbelievableJB and facebook.com/unbelievableJB for the Facebook page.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, as we conclude our discussion today, we started out talking about whether atheists simply believe in one less God than Christians. We talked about theism, deism, atheism. Then we had a bit of a to and fro where Randall, our Christian guest today, was questioning some of Ralph's views as an atheist, whether he can account for objective morality, issue that often comes up in the show, one form or another. We didn't really get to the issue of the complexity of DNA and that sort of thing. Certainly won't have time to deal with that now. Ralph came back with certain questions about, well, A, how can you even talk about objective morality if you're talking about holy books? How can you support a doctrine like hell? And that was where we were kind of talking about as we finished up there. And you were saying, Randall, in that last section, just that you've said that the reason you talk about hell in that way, the way you talk about people cutting themselves off from God as alike to cutting yourself off from oxygen, is simply that if God is the ultimate ground of all being, meaning and so on, if you reject that God, then you are essentially, it's like doing that thing of sort of starving yourself. As we conclude, yeah. Then, Ralph, would you like to respond to anything Randall had to say just in that last section as he concluded?
Yeah, first of all, apologies for not addressing the biology question. I'm not in any way qualified to talk about how DNA evolves, how we account for life on Earth. But I subscribe to the view that there are natural explanations. We don't need to invoke a supernatural creator, and that, more importantly, that would, in my opinion, just be a deistic worldview.
Do you have evidence that there are naturalistic explanations for DNA, which, on the face of it, is a particularly hard puzzle?
Well, true. Yeah, I mean,
because it isn't subject to evolution in the way that from then on things happen.
Yeah, well,
it seems to have been formed almost ready-made as this incredibly complex.
Yeah, I mean, I would just take the view that we will eventually.
Is that a faith on your part then? A faith that naturalism will show us at some point down the line? A naturalistic?
No, I don't think it's a faith. If it's faith, it has to be grounded on no evidence. That's that, or preferring faith to evidence. I think the evidence is very strong.
No Christian holds that definition, or certainly it's not a mainstream definition of faith. That's a caricature. And I mean, you can certainly look at the current evidence for DNA, and you can find that it is, even by your definition, a faith commitment to say, well, there must be some future natural explanation. What it sounds like is a dogmatism, that you're saying you've excluded a priori any agent causal explanation for this phenomena, and you're only going to consider non-agent causal explanations. And that seems to me to be a dogmatism and perhaps a faith claim in the way you've defined it.
But it also, I mean, that your objection sounds like the objection of someone that would espouse creationism as a worldview. It sounds like supernatural explanations are somehow more adequate, that supernatural explanations have ever explained anything, which I would contend, and so would all of the others on the naturalistic side, has never explained anything. There are always explanations for supposedly supernatural occurrences. To say that we don't yet have an understanding of how DNA evolved, and it's also a topic on which I can't speak as an expert in any sense, I'd suggest you have a biologist on. To say that there is not yet a natural explanation is not at all the same thing as saying, therefore, Jesus is God. I think the jumps are extraordinary, and it's about claiming things that we don't have the authority to claim. I don't claim to know anything about how DNA evolved, but the Christian or the deist does claim it. He says, well, you know, this proves that that God was much cleverer than we originally thought. I mean, If we had evolved with this knowledge innate in us, in other words, if we didn't have to discover it as we have done, I think a huge number of people would not believe in God because they would understand that there are natural explanations for natural phenomena.
Well, there's several things you've said here. Let me just highlight a couple of them quickly. First of all, you talked again about me jumping from DNA to say Jesus is God. That's another example of what I was talking about, of trying to isolate a theological claim without any context in order to make it look absurd. I don't move from DNA to Jesus is God. Second point, you introduced this term supernatural, which actually is, from a philosophical perspective, a very difficult term to define adequately. That's why I've stuck with referring to agent causal explanations and non-agent causal explanations, because everybody has a clear sense of what an agent is. And what we need to be keeping in mind is, what is the most adequate explanation for a given phenomena based on the current knowledge that we have? And based on the current knowledge that we have about how highly specified complex information is produced, the best explanation we have for DNA in the cell is an agent causal explanation. And I think you should be open to that. If you're not open to that, then you just seem to be revealing that you're being a dogmatist about this particular issue, and you have a closed and insular worldview on this issue.
I don't think that's the case at all. I think it's a big conclusion to jump to say that all of this complexity implies the involvement of a deity,
of an agent. I mean, we haven't said. I mean,
this is skirting.
Isn't Randall going to say just the same? Well, it's an awful big conclusion to jump to the conclusion that all of this is a result of a completely mindless, predetermined process, which is kind of
not at all. I mean, I think
what presumably your worldview does essentially boil down to is that there's no guiding principle. There's no mind involved, so it mm-hmm. is a mindless, mm-hmm. unguided, probably deterministic as well. I would guess you believe in a sort of deterministic universe at some level. I mean, and that is then very hard to see how we get things like DNA.
Well, I mean, I think things are being explained all the time in through that worldview. I don't think scientists are going to turn around.
It's only that, in my experience, it's been the opposite, that the more we know about it, the harder it is to explain, because we realise level on level on level of complexity.
That's right, yeah. And I don't think that scientists generally subscribe to the conclusion that the more we know about the world. I mean, some do. Some say the more we know, the more we see the glory of God. I say the more we know about the natural world, the more obvious the natural explanations are. I mean, the original question is, how did the world start to exist? Well, you know, we now have, well, not adequate explanations, but we are getting better all the time at explaining these things. Doesn't mean there wasn't a first cause. Doesn't mean that we should ridicule people who say, well, God created the world, although I would object, you know, as many do, who created God. But it does mean that to jump from saying in this we can infer the existence of God to saying now only my definition of God is the way to salvation.
That obviously, I mean, and Randall, you want to make it clear you're not making some jump from a first cause DNA and that kind of thing to now my definition of God is the only one on the table, because obviously, presumably, there'd be a lot of other arguments you would invoke to get there.
Well, for sure. And I mean, my claim about God, I have no doubt that I have false beliefs right now about who God is. I mean, that's just the nature of the human condition. But we all do our best with the current knowledge and evidence we have to understand the universe. I think I've provided some reasons. If we could go on all afternoon, I could provide more as to why Christians take the particular definition of God they do and why they believe there's an agent causal explanation of the universe. So hopefully we could begin to nuance some of Ralph's sweeping claims that there's no evidence at all to support a theistic or Christian perspective.
We are going to have to start to round things up, but it's been really fascinating to have you both going at it this afternoon. Thank you very much for joining me today, Ralph. Why not pick yourself up a copy of the February edition of Christianity magazine if you want to see Ralph talking about his lack of faith there in the Why I'm Not a Christian column. But equally, seek him out online and see some of his stuff. You write occasionally for publications like the Huffington Post and New Statesman and that kind of thing. Anything that we can expect to see in the pipeline in the coming year?
Well, I hope to continue to write articles, and they may be, more and more on things like the Pope retiring and same-sex marriage, which I feel very passionately about. So more
religious
and more articles
and ethical
like
issues
that.
Then?
Well, quite, yeah, religion in the public sphere. Yeah. My personal email address is mrralphjones.co.uk, and the comedy one is theawkwardsilence.co.uk.
Yes, so that's the web addresses for Ralph and the comedy group. Thank you very much, Ralph, for coming in and engaging in the conversation today. Really fascinating to have you in. Details of where you can find Ralph online with the podcast of today's show as well. Equally for Randall as well. Thank you, Randall, for joining me today.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for conversing with me, Ralph.
Thank you.
And I appreciate that in the space of an hour or so, you can only graze the surface of so many topics, but perhaps it'll be a point at which people can go and find out more. And if you want a fuller conversation at a more leisurely pace, why not check out Randall's book, The Swedish Atheist, The Scuba Diver and Other Apologetic Rabbit Trails, and get yourself a coffee and join in the conversation that goes on in that book. I've thoroughly enjoyed it myself, so thank you, Randall, for that. And perhaps we'll see you on the show another time.
Oh, sounds good.
All right. Thank you very much, Randall. Thank you very much, Ralph, for joining me. If you want to find out more about either of my guests, as I say, the website is premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can find the podcast of today's programme, other features, and indeed news about the Unbelievable Conference 2013 happening on Saturday, the 25th of May. Go there, find out more. In the meantime, my thanks to my guests, and we're going to be catching up with some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming next.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So some of your feedback coming up in just a moment's time to the last couple of weeks, and a lot of feedback there was to last week's episode where N.T. Wright or Tom Wright joined me to talk about the new perspective on Paul and justification. And his dialogue partner for that was James White, no stranger to this show, bringing a Reformed Calvinist perspective to the whole issue. We'll come to that in a moment. Just another reminder that Unbelievable the Conference 2013, if you'd like to book in, if you'd like to check out the speakers and so forth, we've got some details on site at the moment, premier.org.uk/Jesus. To register your interest there, and you will be able to book tickets as well very shortly at the site. So we'll go back there. We're just finalising some final details as well, some last speakers that we're just confirming, and the partners for this year's Unbelievable the Conference as well. That's all going to be announced pretty soon. So I'm excited. The third year we've run this, and I think this is going to be the biggest and best yet. So if you can, come along Saturday, the 25th of May in central London. It really is going to be the place to go. And we've got an exciting promotion as well, which I'll tell you about soon. Can't tell you about it today, but an exciting incentive for you to come with someone to the conference this year. All right. Stay tuned. Come back again and find out more. Thanks to Gary, who got in touch via the email address. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. He says, my name's Gary. I live in the US. I've only recently discovered your show and listen regularly on the podcast. I really appreciate and enjoy it. It's very informative, has been very entertaining, edifying and thought-provoking for me. I also appreciate you, Justin, the way you moderate the debates and discussions while bringing the topic into the arena of daily life through your insightful questions is a rare gift among media personalities, at least here in the States. Thanks for the wonderful show and the great job. It's a real blessing in every sense of the word. Gary Feister. Thank you, Gary. I really appreciate that encouragement. It's always lovely to receive emails like that. I don't solicit them, but I do read them. So thank you very much. Dewey. Wanted to get in touch on the episode last week. It was the big Wright versus White show, and a lot of people have downloaded that show, a lot of interesting responses to it. And I did say towards the end, I wonder what atheist agnostic listeners will make of today's show. And indeed, online on the Facebook page and elsewhere, some were saying, oh, that was an hour and a half of my life wasted and that sort of thing, because it was pretty technologically theological and that sort of thing. And Dewey's among those. He's an atheist who says it was an incomprehensible debate between two Christians about I don't know what justification, I think, as set out by St. Paul in the New Testament. Your disputants were potty and as daft as brushes. Well, I know a fair few people who would disagree with you on that, Dewey, but you're entitled to your opinion. You said, gosh, isn't Christianity complicated? And N.T. Wright, I think, said, but at the heart of Christianity, there's something very simple that even small children can understand. I think that small children, like adults, may think they understand something and have sure knowledge of it, but really it's a bunch of ideas with no reality outside their minds and the minds of their elders who fed them those ideas in the first place. The debate and difference between them arises, I think, probably because of inconsistency or incoherence in St. Paul's thinking, and probably there is no reconciling every statement in the book and arriving at one coherent and consistent understanding of it without mind-bending and tedious sophistry. If I wanted to be helpful, I would say our salvation can't possibly hang on our understanding of such obscure points of theology unless God is a pitiless and distinctly unspiritual pedant. Now, I fully expected not that many atheists might be interested in last week's discussion. It obviously assumes a level of believing the Bible, you know, is relevant and has a level of authority, and it's a case of interpretation. But actually, I think your final sentence there, Dewey, does make an important point, which, funnily enough, is sort of actually what the debate was about. I have a feeling James and N.T. Wright would agree with you that salvation doesn't hang on understanding, having a very correct theology around these issues. That wouldn't be salvation at all. I mean, who would be able to be saved if it was about having the right theology? But understanding salvation and theology of salvation from a Christian perspective, nonetheless, is important to many people. So I hope you'll forgive us for veering off into a more theological direction last week. But many people said they really enjoyed it. Paul included says a big thank you for having the programme on New Perspectivism with White and Wright. I did not know a lot about it until Wright came on the program to explain it. The whole program was enlightening and challenged my own understanding of Scripture as well. And contrary to what many atheists have been saying recently in regards to your decision to discuss this topic, it was a very wise decision and became, in my opinion, your best show to date since I've been listening. After listening carefully to Wright's perspective, I would agree with many of his views, but I conclude that his new perspective isn't that new at all in many respects. I found it overemphasizes one area of Scripture, resulting in making his whole argument and Scripture itself a confused and contradictory mess. For the most part, he sounded quite a bit like old school Roman Catholicism repackaged in Protestant trappings. And I'm not sure where you're coming from on this one, but what you say here, Paul, is that his perspective actually is almost completely identical to a cultish group in the US known as the Church of Christ, which grew out of disgruntled Presbyterian ministers with ties to the UK who left their own churches to start their own, all in the name of restoring New Testament Christianity. Anyway, White did a masterful job asking probing questions that got to the heart of this argument. Thank you for the wonderful show. Thank you very much, Paul. Derek is another atheist who disagrees with Dewey, who I read out a moment ago, saying, as an atheist who hasn't studied his New Testament recently, just about all of this show went above my head. However, it was enjoyable to listen to earnest and erudite discussion between two scholars who were obviously completely on top of their subjects. Well done for airing this. So often our media presents us with dumbed down arguments, and most of your shows are accessible to everyone. So having something at this level every once in a while does no harm. It might inspire listeners to dig deeper themselves. Thank you very much, Derek. And I think, Derek, to some extent, when I have had feedback from atheists, whether they enjoyed listening to a theological discussion or not of the nature of last week's show, I think it had actually been often those who've had some Christian experience before. And I know you have, Derek, who were former Christians, who have probably actually said, actually quite enjoyed listening to that because they can at least relate to some of the issues going on from the perspective they once shared. But thank you, Derek, for emailing in. You also wanted to recommend that we do some kind of a theme on politics, a representative of the religious right and someone who stresses the social gospel. And you'd like to sort of do something on, you know, that sort of area. Well, we are actually going to be lining up a program on that. I'm thinking of titling it, Is the Christian Right Wrong? And having different perspectives coming on. So again, that'll be an inter-Christian discussion. But I have a feeling, again, of interest to atheist and agnostic listeners. So look out for that. That's one of the shows that was put out as a suggestion at the beginning of the year when I asked for listeners' ideas for future shows for 2013. And we're trying to make that one happen. Pax in... Chemnitz, who signs off as Pax in Canada, says, great show with N.T. Wright and James White. Really appreciated civil, reasoned and high-level dialogue. I love getting into the meaty theological topics, as there are few other venues for this kind of discussion. Your moderating of it was skillful and kept things moving well. Thank you very much. I must say, I think comments made by both Wright and White confirm that it is high time you got a Lutheran perspective represented. And I find N.T. Wright often makes offhand remarks about Luther and Lutheranism in both his published work and interviews, but gives little substantive evidence that he's studied either the Reformer or the confessional works of the Lutheran Church. I have six of his books, and he does mention Luther occasionally. But he doesn't deal in any depth with Luther's teachings, as far as I can see. And likewise, James White, who I hear so often talk about the need to understand an opponent's arguments, also casually brushed off Luther and Lutheranism with little substantive critique. Though I do realise that was not the focus of the show. Perhaps this would be a good topic to bring some Lutheran theologians on for your next dialogue. I know Dr. Charles Gieschen, I think it's pronounced, of Concordia Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, has addressed Wright and some of the new perspective issues, as well as Dr. Andrew Das at Elmhurst College in the US. So a plea for a Lutheran from Chemnitz in Canada. Thank you very much, Chemnitz. Roy Solomon says, fantastic debate between James and Tom last week. I think Dr. James White really focused on creating a useful resource for the church, but it was clear he didn't have enough time to prepare. This was very interesting to hear the debate unfold. I've listened twice already and will probably listen to it again. I saw someone else actually comment on the Facebook page that they they had listened, but they were going to listen again with a pen and paper to hand because it was so dense in the amount of stuff that was said and things referenced that they wanted to go through it again with a bit more time. You appreciated Dr. White's commitment to represent Tom Wright as accurately as possible. And on another note, I'd love to hear Tom Stark in dialogue with someone at some point. Particularly, you want to hear a dialogue between Tom Stark, the historian, and Paul Copan, who wrote Is God a Moral Monster? I think Tom Stark did write a critique of Copan's book, didn't he? So that's what you'd like to see. Suggested topics could include women in the Old Testament, slaves, rape in the Old Testament, the law in the Old Testament. Anyway, thank you very much, Roy. Always appreciate ideas for shows. Thank you if you've been getting in touch as well for ideas for shows and that sort of thing. Jay Cousins has been emailing a lot recently, an atheist, again, someone formerly of a Christian background. But he wanted to thank me for mentioning him on the show of last week. You said, driving through Beverly Hills, listening to the podcast, and all of a sudden you were talking to me. Made me smile. Thanks, Justin, and keep up the good work. Thanks for being in touch, Jay, and thanks to all those who have been in touch. I hope you enjoyed today's show, and if you want more details on my guests, do check out the website, the podcast, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And I'll post a link there as well to the article from Christianity Magazine that Ralph featured in recently on why I'm not a Christian. Be interested to get your responses to that. Christianity Magazine, I occasionally write for it, and it is a great publication. If you want to get a free copy, if you're not a subscriber, you can do that by visiting their website, christianitymagazine.co.uk. For now, it's time for me to say goodbye. Come back again at the same time next week.
You're unbelievable.
We're going to be revisiting the issue of hell, something we've done a few times on the programme over the years. But a recent movie documentary by Kevin Miller puts the whole question of universalism back into focus. We're going to be hearing from Kevin himself. We'll be hearing extracts from the film. And we'll also be talking to Christian philosopher Glenn Peoples, who's an annihilationist. Also with me will be Peter Sanlon, who takes a traditional eternal conscious torment view. So all the views represented, as it were, here in the studio. And we'll be hearing their discussion same time next week. Hope you can join me for that. Until then, have a good week, and I'll see you next time.